Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. Excuse me. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-5376, American Forest Resource Council Appellant versus H. Dale Hall et al. Mr. Rutzik for the appellant, Ms. Newman for the Appalese Hall et al., and Ms. Boyles for Appalese Audubon et al.
Good morning. The mandatory five-year review of listed species was added to the Endangered Species Act in 1978. And in the subsequent 24 years, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service completed a total of one five-year review of a species. In 2002, my client, the American Forest Resource Council, sued the Fish and Wildlife Service to compel five-year reviews for two controversial West Coast threatened species, the northern spotted owl listed in 1990 and the Washington, Oregon, and California population of marbled murrelets listed in 1992. The service settled the case by agreeing to do the five-year reviews. There are about 900,000 murrelets in Alaska, about 70,000 in Canada, and about 25,000 in Washington, Oregon, and California. In the murrelet review, the service decided that the then-listed three-state population does not qualify for listing as a distinct population segment, or DPS. The service then decided, with no explanation, that it would nonetheless keep the population on the list of threatened species. This decision was arbitrary and capricious under the most fundamental principles of administrative law. It runs counter to the evidence. It is not logical or rational. There's no rational connection between the facts found and the choice made, and a conclusion supported with no explanation is, as this court has said, the epitome of arbitrary and capricious decision making. The service's position in this appeal is that it did have a basis for its decision, and even though it did not articulate that basis, the court should uphold it because, quote, the agency's path may reasonably be discerned.
Aren't we going to have another decision from the agency by May 28th?
We're going to have, there is a decision.
Aren't we supposed
required.
To? Yes.
Yes, that is correct.
Won't that moot this?
No, because we don't know what.
If the agency determines on May 28th that it should continue to be listed, then that will moot this.
Well, it depends. That may or may not moot this, because if it shouldn't have been listed then back in 2004, then it shouldn't have been listed.
Well, you have a right to judicial review of that May 28th decision if that were the decision, right?
If that were the decision, that's correct.
And if the decision were made to delist it, then it would go through, then there would be a rule proposed. Correct?
That's correct. The third alternative is that they could find that listing is warranted but precluded, mm-hmm. which means what it says, that it's warranted but they aren't going to do it anyway. And that is not subject to judicial review.
And if we ruled in your favor, what you want is an order to the agency that it initiate a rulemaking.
Yes, correct.
Which would be the same thing that will happen if the agency determines on May 28th that it should be delisted.
It could be, yes. It could be, in effect, the same thing. We don't know what they're going to decide or if they're going to decide, because the track record here is that they have not met their statutory.
Suppose we knew they were going to meet it. Would that moot the case?
It wouldn't moot the case as of today.
Nah, as of May 28th.
Well, it depends what the decision is. No. I don't know. There are circumstances where it could effectively make this unnecessary. There are circumstances where the case remains valid and should go forward.
Can I ask you, you're not arguing that there is no no change in status option for the department, right? I mean, but for the change in the discrete population segment coupled with no change in status, that's necessary to your argument, right? In other words, if they found nothing about, if they found the discrete population segment existed and found no change in status, you're not saying that's not within the statutory language.
You're right. The decision whether or not to, whether or not the species should be removed from the list is a discretionary judgment with scientific input, and there's nothing mandatory about that. What is mandatory is that they make a decision, and that if they decide the species should be listed, the word should being in quotes, that they must initiate the rulemaking to delist the species. The decision
is there a statutory timetable for by when they have to initiate the rulemaking?
There is not for this type of rulemaking. It is similar to the situation where the agency on its own proposes to list or delist the species. There is no statutory deadline for making the decision, in contrast to when the agency is responding to a petition to list or delist. There are statutory deadlines, but in the voluntary initiation of rulemaking, there isn't, and in response to the five-year review, there also isn't. The hidden but supposedly discernible basis of the decision is that the Merlet DPS was not really listed in 1992 as a DPS, but rather, as the service wrote on page 32 of its brief, quote, the species was originally listed on the alternate ground that it was threatened throughout a significant portion of its range. And so they argue the birds can continue to be listed even if they are not a DPS. There are two defects in this argument. The first is that it's simply not true. The service has continuously maintained since 1992 that the birds were listed as a DPS, not as a significant portion of the range. The 1992 Federal Register notice listing the population on page 172 of the appendix says, at the time of proposing to list the marbled murrelet in Washington, Oregon, and California, the service considered the murrelets in these states to constitute a distinct population segment. And they go on, the only supportable decision that can be reached within the limit imposed by the court is to list the population as proposed. In 1997, when they wrote the recovery plan for the murrelet population, they said that the service, quote, recognized the marbled murrelet population in Washington, Oregon, and California as a distinct vertebrate population segment.
But didn't this lower court say that in the 92 final rule that the three states encompass roughly one-third of the geographic area comprising a significant portion of its range?
The Seattle U.S. District Court decision in 1992 did contain that statement.
Well, Judge Bates is citing to the Federal Register. Does the Federal Register then have that?
The Federal Register has that in the section of the notice on distinct population segment. That's part of the explanation for why they concluded it was a distinct population segment, not an alternate ground, as they are recently arguing.
Mr. Rudnick, in the recovery plan reference you just made, is that in the appendix?
That is not in the appendix. That is cited in our reply brief. It is, there's an online citation for that.
Thank you.
In the five-year review that they did, the first question they asked, and this is page 93 of the appendix, the first question was, does the currently listed distinct population segment meet the criteria established in the service's 1996 DPS policy? In fact, it would make no sense whatever for them to discuss the DPS if they had not listed it as a DPS. And in 2006, the service reported to Congress, they do a biannual recovery report, quote, the Marble Merlet was listed as a DPS in California, Oregon, and Washington. So there's simply no doubt that the Merlet population was listed as a DPS and only as a DPS. The second problem with the service's argument is that it's pure post hoc rationalization from their lawyers. There's nothing in the record to indicate that the Fish and Wildlife Service ever actually relied on the rationale that is now being offered. Nowhere in the five-year review does the service state that it believes or has ever determined that these merlets are a significant portion of the range. They do quote that same U.S. District Court decision where the court said, and there are reasons we explained the court was wrong, but that's not even relevant here. The court said it was a significant portion of the range, but as we've seen, that's not what the service actually did. They actually listed it as a DPS. And the five-year review does not say they agree with the Seattle court. In fact, they say the opposite. They say the reason they proposed to do the range-wide review, which they still haven't actually done, was to determine, quote, whether the population in California, Oregon, and Washington constitutes a significant portion of the range of the species. They wouldn't be studying that if they had already made the determination.
Can I ask you just on a different track on the final agency action issue?
Sure.
There's no requirement in the statute that there be a rulemaking initiated.
Well, there is. And the requirement arises from the words of the statute read in the context of four rules of statutory interpretation that are applicable.
There's nothing like there was in the Fox case, right? In the Fox case, there was a statute that said the FCC shall repeal or modify any regulation it determines to no longer be in the public interest. There's nothing quite that specific. You're arguing more from the context and the structure, I gather.
Well, no, it actually is exactly that specific, with a single exception that the word used is should rather than shall. It says that the secretary shall make a determination whether the species should be removed. If it said shall, they seem to agree, the service seems to agree, that that would be a mandatory duty that would make it.
You would still have to go through a rulemaking, correct?
Well, of course, and that's true in
Fox.
Well,
you say of course, but...
But that was true in Fox as well.
Mm-hmm. But it referred to the rulemaking in Fox because it said shall repeal or modify any regulation. I realize this is a highly technical argument, but it really does seem to be the language, type of language that the Supreme Court's focused on in trying to determine whether something's final agency action.
Well, that's correct. And the word should in the context of this statute is used four other times in the same section of the Endangered Species Act. And each of those times, it is used in a way that gives it a mandatory meaning, a shall meaning. Secondly, or maybe firstly, I think the biggest argument is that...
Doesn't the fact, as Judge Ginsburg pointed out, there's no deadline for conducting a rulemaking further suggest that this is not the kind of final agency action we usually review?
No, because that could be said of in the Fox case or in any APA case. The APA does not impose a mandatory deadline for either initiating or completing a rulemaking. That doesn't mean that an agency may not have a duty to initiate or that a decision not to initiate a rulemaking is in final agency action. A decision not to initiate a rulemaking is final agency action, and that's pretty much settled. The question is whether they made a decision not to initiate a rulemaking. They did make that decision. Under their interpretation, the second part of this statute, which is section 4C2B, there are two parts. One is do the five-year review. The second is when you're done, make a determination whether the species should be removed from the list. Under their interpretation, the second half of the statute is meaningless. It's a recommendation from the agency to itself. And that does not meet the rule of statutory interpretation. The statutes are supposed to mean something. I've run out of time, so I'll save my last few seconds unless there are more questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rudnick.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Jennifer Scheller Newman for the Fish and Wildlife Service. Two threshold issues should prevent this court from reaching the merits of AFRC's argument. First, AFRC has not submitted sufficient evidence to demonstrate that it has standing to raise its claim. And second, the document that is attempting to challenge the five-year review determination is not a final agency action because no legal consequences flow from that document.
What about mootness?
I realize that the interveners have made that argument. The government believes that the case will become moot whenever the agency issues the new combined five-year review determination and 12-month finding.
When will that be?
They're supposed to issue it May 28th, I believe, is the date, and they're working diligently, as far as I know, to do that. Hopefully they will meet the deadline, but they haven't yet issued it, so we don't think that the case is yet moot.
You're not committing to a decision from the agency by May 28th?
No.
Well, if it doesn't, if mootness is, if the case becomes moot when and only when, or even only potentially when, depending on the decision, the agency makes its further decision, then it's important to know whether that's going to be soon or not. Because if it's going to be a considerable amount of time, there's no room for saying that the case is even prudentially moot.
I asked the folks at the agency that I could to give me, you know, if there was a firm date that they knew for sure they were going to have a decision, and they didn't have one. So unfortunately, that's the situation we're in. We believe the case will become moot, but it hasn't yet. However, there are these other issues that we think should prevent this court from reaching the merits of AFRC's claim.
You mean standing?
Standing, and
what,
also...
What else?
And the final agency action, which I realize is a part of the cause of action here. With respect to standing, AFRC's declaration, the Parton Declaration, simply does not contain the elements the Supreme Court has said you must have to show that you have standing. It doesn't speak with sufficient particularity about which of AFRC's members are going to be injured by this action, and it also does not describe those injuries with sufficient particularity. It doesn't tie the injuries to any specific sites or projects, and those are things that AFRC needed to do to show that it had standing. If this court nevertheless concludes that there is enough there for standing, the five-year review determination is not a final agency action because the Endangered Species Act does not require the Fish and Wildlife Service to promulgate a rule after the conclusion
the
of the
point,
five-year
then?
Review determination. The point, the five-year review determination was designed to force the agencies, both Fish and Wildlife and Commerce, to periodically look at the status of listed species and review
just
the science.
For their own edification?
Just for their own edification and to provide them with the information that they may need should they choose later to initiate some sort of rulemaking.
The statute uses the words word determine and determination, which are usually the words of final agency action.
Except for here, the statute does not tie that to any particular obligation to promulgate a rule. For instance, in the petition context, if someone presents a petition and the agency determines that some sort of listing action, change in listing status is warranted, the statute says that the agency shall promptly promulgate a rule, a proposed rule, that would carry out that action. Congress just didn't impose that duty here. There is an added meaning also for these five-year review determinations, which is that if the agency, you know, the agency is gathering all sorts of scientific information, making it available for the public, and then interested persons like AFRC can then use the petition process that Congress designed in the statute to force the agency to act and to force them to act in a timely manner and then to get judicial review of that decision. That is the mechanism that AFRC should have pursued if it wanted to get the Miralet delisted. And that's an action that AFRC has now pursued. The agency has already issued a 90-day finding, concluding that some sort of listing action may be warranted. And as we've just discussed, it's on its way to making a 12-month finding, which then, if it concludes that the Miralet should be delisted, will require it to propose a rule. That is the stage where we have the sort of decision that this court has talked about before, which is a decision whether or not to initiate rulemaking that would be final agency action. It's just not here, since there are no deadlines and no requirements, that the agency propose a rule to carry out any of the determinations in these five-year review determinations. There's another way in which I think this case is distinguishable from the Fox Television, in addition to what the court has pointed out with there being specific language in the Telecommunications Act of 1996 saying that the agency shall repeal or modify a rule that meets the statutory criteria. Also, the Telecommunications Act was an act that was designed to force the FCC to deregulate an industry. And I don't think there's the same sort of thrust with the Endangered Species Act.
Well, this provision's designed to force the agency not to have outdated listings or outdated determinations. I mean, I think that's the same kind of congressional direction.
But it's missing that final step. It's designed to force the agency to gather the scientific information to give them the tools that they would need to change a listing status, or to give the public the tools it might need to initiate the petition process, which would force a decision.
The petition process wasn't there when this provision was first enacted.
Correct? That is correct. However, it wasn't there in the sort of formal form that it is now. Of course, anyone could always petition an agency to take an action. And this court has held repeatedly that the denial of a petition for rulemaking is a final agency action that's reviewable. So even without this specific language, they could still get to that point. I think there's another point here that this really is not the consummation of the agency's decision-making process. This sort of ties into whether or not this is a decision not to initiate rulemaking. And what the agency said was, we don't think that this is a distinct population segment. However, it recognized that that 1992 district court decision that came out during the process of listing the Miralet said that it didn't matter whether this was a distinct population segment because the species was threatened throughout a significant portion of its range. And in order to address this outstanding issue, the agency rightly concluded that it needed more information. It needed to do this range-wide status review. And until that occurs, there's not really a decision to whether or not to initiate rulemaking. All we have at most is the deferral of rulemaking, which again, this court has repeatedly said is not a final agency action reviewable under the APA.
What are the practical consequences to the agency if these are subject to judicial review?
I think the practical consequence for the agency is that they're in a situation where no one needs to petition the agency to say, hey, we're really concerned about this status of this particular species. There's sort of basically the six-year statute of limitations sort of never runs on the agency. They're just always subject to surprise litigation on any particular species every time they do the five-year review determination.
But it's really not going to be much of an extra burden because anyone who's presumably interested in litigating that would have also petitioned for the delisting, right?
Presumably,
although that cuts both ways, I realize.
That's right, and of course, here the appellant here did not petition for delisting until just I believe about a year ago. They filed their petition right after the district court decision. I want to speak for a second about why this particular decision was not arbitrary and capricious, and I touched on it a little bit a minute ago. But really, everything in that five-year review determination points to the Marble Miralet in California, Washington, and Oregon remaining listed under the Endangered Species Act. The threat situation still indicates that the Miralet is likely to become endangered in those areas. The recovery criteria have not been met, and the populations of the bird at best are stable or continue to decline, according to the information the agency had. And the only thing that tended to indicate that the species should not be delisted was this distinct population segment legal analysis. And as I've already explained, because of that 1992 district court decision, which said that you never needed to get to the question of whether this was a distinct population segment because it was threatened throughout a significant portion of its range, a third of its range. The agency was correct in not simply initiating delisting proceedings right away based on the distinct population segment analysis. And because there was a little bit of talk about the appropriate remedy, should this court get all the way to the merits, I just want to note that the appropriate remedy is for the district court to vacate the five-year review determination, which is the action under review, and the agency should have a new opportunity to explain its reasoning in that document.
Which gets back to the mootness thing.
Yes, it
does. The new five-year reviews due at the same time, the May 28th, right? I guess that's folded together now.
That's right. I mean, as a practical matter, by the time that could happen, this case is very likely going to be moot.
Right.
By when?
By whenever the district court could order the agency to vacate the current five-year review determination and issue a new one. I mean, they're already working on it, so.
By the time the district court could issue the order? That could be tomorrow.
Well, I suppose it could be. If the district court were very fast, yes, that is true.
You're assuming it takes us a while to decide, there's an in-bank process, that, you know, petitions, so that delays it. Yeah.
Perhaps.
So we're talking about a few months?
That would be my guess, yes.
Let me, I want to ask you about the statute for a moment, about a reading of the statute. And for A in particular, or A and C, looking at 4C1 first, it concludes by saying, the Secretary shall from time to time revise each list published under the authority of this subsection to reflect recent determinations, etc., in accordance with subsections A and B.
Mm-hmm.
And then goes on in C2B3 to say each determination under subparagraph B shall be made in accordance with the provisions of subsections A and B. So doesn't that tell us that in order to proceed here, to complete its obligations, the service has to run through the rulemaking required or described in B.
When the agency chooses to do its from time to time updating of the lists and revising of the lists, yes, that must be done through a rulemaking process. Does that incorporate, for example, the deadlines associated with the petition process? And I think the answer to that question is no. That's the one the Ninth Circuit addressed in the Coos County case.
I don't think that was the question.
I'm sorry, then I don't think I understood.
Well,
the question's not the deadlines. The question's whether a rulemaking must be initiated as a result of the reference to A and B, I think.
That's
right.
That's correct.
Part A does not require the Secretary to start a rulemaking. What it says is that if the agency is going to list a species, whenever it does it through its own voluntary process, not outside of the petition process, in order to actually accomplish that, a rulemaking must occur. But it doesn't place an affirmative obligation to sort of go out and survey all the species and initiate rulemakings for every species that must be listed. It gives the agency more discretion than that.
You've done that, and it says if you determine that a species should be listed, I'm assuming you've done that. And then it says, if you determine that a species should be listed, right, then this really goes back to the petitioner, plaintiff's claim here, appellant's claim that they should be as a shall.
Right.
Right. If you do that, then aren't you into the requirements of C1? And C2B3.
I don't think so, because those specific requirements talking about species who are already listed in subsection C say, for example, the secretary shall from time to time revise each list. And you know, the only mandatory obligation is that the agency must do the five-year review. It must take a look. It must draw a conclusion. But the statute does not explicitly provide, as it does in many other places, that a rulemaking must be initiated in order to carry out any of those determinations.
Well, look at C2B. Secretary shall determine on the basis of such review whether any such species should be removed or changed, status changed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And each determination under subparagraph B, which you just mentioned, shall be made in accordance with the provisions of A and B by rulemaking.
That's right.
So the last sentence is shall be.
Oh, I'm sorry. The each determination under subparagraph B shall be made in accordance with. I think that, again, goes back to the Coos County case, talking about what the statute was really trying to do was to incorporate the substantive standards that the agency should be looking at. For example, in section A1A through E talks about the criteria which might lead the agency to conclude that a species should be listed as either endangered or threatened. That is the standard that's trying to be, that the statute is incorporating there whenever it says in accordance with A and B of this section.
Well, B, what about the B part? B5 and B6 in particular.
Well, the first part of B is talking again about the basis of the determination.
Let's go to B5 and 6.
Again, B5 starts with respect to any regulation proposed. Mm-hmm. So that only is kicking in obligations once the agency has actually proposed a regulation to either list a species or change the status in some way. And again, 6 is also talking about the period after the agency actually proposes a regulation and imposes a time frame on when it must make a decision on that proposed regulation.
If you made a determination under A that the status should be changed, okay, then doesn't C tell us that you are to follow through and do that pursuant to the procedures in A and particularly B?
I don't think it does, because if you look at subpart A, it again starts out with the process of actually initiating the regulation. And because Congress knew how to tell the agency specifically to start the initiation of the regulation process, and it just didn't do that in C. And it also didn't do it in A. It didn't give the agency some sort of general obligation to evaluate all species and initiate regulations. The secretary has to have some discretion whenever it is deciding what species are going to be going through the listing process. Now, Congress did remove some of that discretion by giving this explicit petition process, which forces the agency to deal with specific species that the public brings to the agency's attention. But whenever you're outside of that process, the agency does not have an obligation to initiate rulemakings to change statuses or to do initial listings.
Okay.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Kristen Boyles, and I'm here for the environmental interveners in this case. I have 3 points this morning that I think I will slightly rearrange in light of the court's question. I think it's important to highlight the fact that what Fish and Wildlife Service did here was not make a decision in or determination in the 5-year status review to change the species listings. They made a determination to keep the listing in place. And so this is not a case where they thought it should be delisted and then didn't act. They looked at the entire record. They looked at other parts of the listing requirements other than simply the distinct population segment requirement. AFRC's arguments ignore the fact that the murrelets were listed as threatened because of the significant portion of the range question that the district court in Seattle ordered in 1992. They ignore the fact that the status review found that the interim recovery goals and the recovery plan hadn't been met. That's at appendix page 108. They ignore the fact that the service found that the threats had not changed for this species in all that period of time. That's appendix at page 112. And they ignore the entire scientific review, which portions are at appendix at 122, which said that the species is declining, not just in the three-state population that we're talking about, but then later on we find that it's declining as well in British Columbia and Alaska. All of that is what the service was looking at, not simply this legal question of distinct population segment. This, especially since the Endangered Species Act incorporates the precautionary principle to err on the side of species, the fact that Fish and Wildlife Service decided not to delist the species and not to begin a delisting process in 2004 is supported by this record. And I think that that highlights the fact that AFRC has not been without recourse here. The ESA has the statutorily prescribed petition process for citizens to petition to protect species or to remove the protections from species. And although it waited almost 4 years after the 2004 status review, AFRC has petitioned to delist the murrelet, and in fact, Fish and Wildlife Service in October issued a positive finding on that petition, finding that it was based on substantial evidence. That process is moving forward. That is an administrative process that will redress AFRC's concerns. I don't understand how that will not be moot once the decision is issued, how that will not, moot this case once the decision is issued. Their decision will be either no, it should not be delisted, or yes, it should be delisted and we'll begin a proposed process. But that is why we have asked this court not to get involved in this case at this time, to short circuit that administrative process. That's the way the status reviews and the statutory listing provisions work together to make this ESA process make sense.
There were no petition for delisting process. I read your brief to hint that you would agree that this is final agency action, footnote 5 of your brief.
I think it would be, you get the hint, Your Honor. I think it would be a closer question. And I think that's why Congress in 82 added the citizen petition process. Remember, the provisions we're talking about in the status review are added to the ESA in 1978. And then there was still concern that the agency wasn't moving, it wasn't acting. And the petition process was added in 1982 to get the agency to have a way for citizens to force the agency to take measures that citizens thought were appropriate.
So your argument seems less a final agency action argument than an argument that Congress intended to have review channeled through one mechanism and not another.
I don't disagree with the final agency action argument, Your Honor, but I believe that is actually the case. I believe Congress was enacting a provision that citizens would be able to bring these issues. It put statutory deadlines so that they would have the requirements that would be met that can be enforced. If the deadlines are missed, people bring lawsuits about missed deadlines all the time for Fish and Wildlife Service. And that is the way that the statute makes sense. Otherwise, as Ms. Newman said, you are going to have this constant 5-year rollover of every single species listed. Every single time a status review comes up, you have to go through a brand new, potentially rulemaking process to keep species on lists. I don't believe that AFRC has brought a judicial...
Say that again? You're not going to need a rulemaking process to keep...
But that is what Mr.
on the list.
But
they're only if you're changing the status quo.
That's what would make logical sense. But Mr. Rutzig's argument is that based on this status review, they should have initiated a delisting, and this status review found the species should remain
he's
listed.
Talking about he's making that point for his final agency action argument.
That may be true, but the switch between those also highlights the switch between the requested remedy that Mr. Rutzig has asked for, which is sometimes he asks for this court to order the administrative process to continue that's already going on, and sometimes he believes that the court should order the delisting of the murrelet outright. And I think that that's also a highlighting of how the claims here don't match up to the way the statute works and to the way judicial review works. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Boyles.
I have 4 points. First, to clarify what I said about mootness, the only reason this case would become moot is if the decision that whenever it comes out is a decision to propose delisting. That would resolve the case. If the decision is not to propose delisting, yes, we have the right to seek judicial review of that decision. That is an alternative remedy to the remedy that we're seeking in this case. That does not foreclose the remedy that we're seeking in this case. And that was another of the Fox television.
If you prevailed here, your primary argument for why you should prevail on the merits is that there was a lack of reasoned explanation.
Yes.
And so it would be sent back to the agency for the reasoned explanation, which presumably is going to be part of what has already happened accompanying the decision on the petition for delisting. In other words, the explanation.
But now we're speculating, unfortunately, as to not only what the decision is, but how they write the decision and how they justify the decision when we have really no idea.
But our decision, even if we agreed with you on that basis, wouldn't tell them how to write the decision.
Of course, you wouldn't tell them how to write the decision. But as Ms. Boyle suggested, we did argue in the district court that the court has the power to vacate the 1992 listing.
I'm not sure I see that, but.
Well, we'll reserve that for another time. And in any event, we're not asking this court to do that. We're saying that's a district court issue. Point number two, what is the practical effect, I'm answering Judge Kavanaugh's question, of allowing judicial review? Well, if you allow judicial review, you will get reasoned decisions with explanations of reasoning and a rational connection between the facts found and the choice made. If you don't allow judicial review, you get none of that. And what you effectively do is go back to the quarter century era when they didn't even bother to do 5-year reviews. Because after all,
as a practical matter, couldn't that be accomplished by petitions for delisting and the judicial review that's expressly associated with that?
Well, sure, but what if they take the tack of saying...
I take your point that would render this provision relatively meaningless, but still there are the petitions for delisting that interested parties can constantly file, correct?
Well, let's say they stop doing the 5-year reviews. If it's not final agency action, then the public has no remedy at all. Yeah. Or they make it one sentence and they say, looks good to me. Well, there's no remedy for that if there's no judicial review, then the whole process withers away. That's the practical effect. Number three, on standing, in paragraph 9 of, and this just came up on Friday, as you may know, paragraph 9 of our statement of material facts not in dispute, we identified three specific companies that are members of AFRC that are named, that were plaintiffs in the original 2002 case that got the 5-year review in the first place. And the declaration of the head of the association specifically says that members are threatened in the management of their own land. The point is that anyone who owns a piece of forest land within the range of the Marble Murrelet faces a risk of civil and criminal sanctions if they take, meaning harm, harass, disrupt, a Marble Murrelet. You can't be more specific than that. And the government's response to paragraph 9 of our statement of material facts not in dispute was that they did not dispute the facts. So the facts were alleged, established, proven, and not disputed. This is not in any way like the Summers case where the argument was that the argument wasn't even in a declaration. It was in a pleading and said, we're a large organization. We have 700,000 members. There must be one of us who must have gone to a place that would be affected by the regulation they were challenging. That is not what we've said at all. We're far more specific than that. And I will conclude on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rutnick. Thank you all. The case is submitted and the court will take a brief recess.
Stand, please.